You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. The world economy is teetering. The weather is nuts and dangerous. So let's talk about plankton. Those little critters in the ocean we never see produce most of the oxygen you are breathing right now. They are the bottom of the food chain for ocean life, and they are in trouble. Here to chat about all this is a regular EcoShock correspondent, climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Paul, welcome back.
Hello, Alex. It's always great to be talking with you.
I appreciate it, too. You know, first of all, I was kind of shocked at what the word plankton really means. It's about as scientific as saying a zillion little things in the ocean we mostly can't see. You know, I mean, Paul, what is plankton really?
Well, plankton are very, very tiny plants, and like any other plants, they require carbon dioxide, they require sunlight, and they also require nutrients. So in the ocean, they only get that sunlight if they're near the surface of the ocean, and they get the nutrients mostly from upwelling from deeper water levels, and of course there's lots of CO2, and we're providing ever more amounts of CO2 for them.
Right. And just to be clear for listeners, there is also zooplankton, the animal types of plankton, but we're not going to be talking about them in this show. Okay, so a lot of troubling and amazing science is coming out about plankton in just the past couple of years. Why do you think, Paul, scientists are working so hard on these tiny sea creatures?
Well, phytoplankton, apart from being the base of the food chain in the oceans, and they are mostly consumed by the zooplankton, as you mentioned, the very tiny animal plankton. They provide lots of the oxygen in the air that we breathe. In fact, it was the evolution of plants on the planet which created the oxygen in our atmosphere that we breathe. And presently, it's believed that about every second breath you take contains oxygen that is derived from phytoplankton in the ocean.
I didn't really appreciate just how big these fields of plankton, I would call them, are until I looked at some of the satellite photos. How would you describe these pools of sea life to people who haven't seen those photographs?
Well, the CYFS satellite, for example, measures the colors on the surface of the ocean. And when you get these massive phytoplankton blooms, there's pigments in the plant material which contain chlorophyll, which is a green color, which gives plants the green color. And so you see these vast areas that are shaded green, or some types of plankton are brown, but they're different colors. If you have the open ocean and there's a lack of plankton, then it's very, very clear. There's a lack of sediment and so on, open ocean, and it's stratified. For example, if it's very warm, the warm water's on top. There's not a lot of mixing with colder water down below. So there's not a lot in that water, so it's very, very clear, and it's that characteristic blue color that we see in the water when we go to the Caribbean, for example. That water is that color because of a lack of phytoplankton for the most part.
All right, well, you've kind of given us a hint about this, but where are the biggest masses of plankton on Earth? Where do they thrive?
Well, the biggest masses are large masses in areas where there is upwelling. So, for example, off the western coast of the United States, you have the Pacific Current, which is going southward along the coastline, and because of deflection from the Coriolis force rotation of the Earth, it deflects to the right, so it pulls away from the coastline, and in its place, water comes up. Water is forced up to replace the water that's pulling away, and that water coming up comes from its deeper water, colder water that contains lots of nutrients. So those nutrient-rich regions then stimulate the phytoplankton blooms, which stimulate the zooplankton blooms to eat them, and then the larger fish and all the way up the food chain, they will go to that area, and you get a proliferation of marine life and great fishing, great food supply for humanity from these regions. So anywhere you get upwelling of ocean currents, you get very, very large amounts of plankton. So if you're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, far from anything, and there's no reason for upwelling. I mean, there's always some mixing from winds and wave action and so on, but if you don't get geographic features to give you upwelling, then you, the water will generally be clear and be lacking phytoplankton.
Now, according to a study in 2010, we've already lost about 40% of the plankton in the world oceans. Could you tell us about that study, please?
Yeah, so this study, it's by Boyce et al., came out around the end of July 2010, and it was titled something like Global Phytoplankton Decline Over the Past Century. So it divided the ocean up into 10 regions, and it looked at the decline in each of these regions, both from satellite information going back to the late 70s, and then prior to that from measurements that they had, from measurements of, for example, dragging nets through the ocean, measuring the plankton, depending on the mesh size of the nets and things like that. And they came up with a figure of about a 40% decline since 1950 to 2010 when the study was published. So that indicates a cumulative rate of about 0.86% decline per year in the levels since 1950 to give you that 40% decline over that 60-year time period.
Well, now I'd read that, but then I got a little tidbit in a newsletter from Jim Thomas of the ETC Group saying the loss might not be as great as thought. The disappearance of plankton may be partly due to misreading satellites. And Jim cited the paper Reevaluating Ocean Warming Impacts on Global Phytoplankton that was published in the journal Nature Climate Change on October 26, 2015. Did you have a look at that paper, and what do you think?
Yes, I did have a look at that paper, and that paper is fascinating, and it's very hopeful. The argument of that paper is that the root cause of the changes in the ocean is the increasing heat that's being absorbed in the ocean, and that warmer sea surface temperature, the warmer water is lighter, so it tends to float easier on the surface, and therefore it inhibits vertical mixing. But those temperature changes will influence a number of things. So this recent paper that you mentioned talks about the idea of the, I guess previous studies have assumed that if you measure chlorophyll, then that's a direct relationship to the amount of plankton that are there creating that color, that contain that chlorophyll. But this paper is saying that the actual nature of the phytoplankton can be changing because the water is warmer and the nutrient levels are warmer. And, for example, the phytoplankton can still be there in large quantities, but if they're getting lighter of color, if they have less chlorophyll and they're getting lighter, then the satellites would detect them as being in lower concentration when they actually might be there doing their photosynthesis, but not registering on the satellite. I mean, one thing's for sure is we need a lot more studies and a lot more information on this, because we think that most of the photosynthesis in plants goes on in the chlorophyll, the chloroplasts, which create, you know, contain chlorophyll, which create that green color. So if the green color is not there, there can be more phytoplankton there, but maybe the photosynthesis level is lower. So there's things called photoacclimatization, where when plants are exposed to a brighter environment, then the efficiency of the photosynthesis process is increased, so therefore the plants can have less centers where they're doing that photosynthesis, for example. We know if the CO2 levels are different in the atmosphere, if they're higher, plants tend to evolve to have fewer stomata, which is the area where the gas is exchanged with the plant, because they can extract energy more efficiently from the photosynthetic process. They don't need as many sort of centers of photosynthesis. So in that case, this is what's going on. We're seeing the interaction of the biosphere, more specifically the flora, the plants that are changing. And also, you know, you have to look at how the animals can also be changing, because if there's more phytoplankton that are being produced, for example, then there can be more feeding done from the zooplankton. It all enters into the equation. But this study is showing that, I mean, this is a very, very key thing. I mean, obviously, if these phytoplankton produce 50% of the oxygen that we breathe, we need to really find out all about their cycles and the levels and how they're affected by not only ocean temperature, but also ocean acidification. Because certain phytoplankton, like diatoms, are based on silicon dioxide sort of backbone or shell, very small, of course, but a glass lattice, and that isn't affected so much by the pH dropping of the ocean, by the ocean acidification. And those are large plankton, But other smaller plankton like coccolithopores or forams, foraminifera, those phytoplankton require the calcium carbonate backbone. And of course, as the pH of the ocean is dropping, it's harder for them to form their shell. So you would expect with acidification that those plankton would be affected more than others. But there was a recent study. A third study was actually looking specifically just at the diatom levels. And it reported that the diatoms, which are the phytoplankton based on the silicon dioxide or glass lattice shell, had been declining in the northern hemisphere by about 1% per year from 1998 to 2012. And this was a global study, and they found that the decline was largest in the North Pacific, the North Indian Ocean, and the Equatorial Indian Ocean. And these diatoms are much larger phytoplankton than the calcium-based ones. So there's a lot of different components that are going on here, and I don't think we have a clear picture. But the paper that you refer to would indicate, you know, if it's actually more of a color change than a phytoplankton number change, then the drops may be more like 7 or 8% relative to 1950, between 2010 and 1950. It might be a much smaller decline than that 40%. So that would be very hopeful if that was the case.
Well, as you say, we'll have to find out. We need more research because it's very important stuff. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. You know, Paul, it's odd for me to say I'm talking with a Canadian climate scientist. So many of them were more or less banned from talking with the media by former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I had to call someone in England or the United States to find out what Canadian climate scientists were doing, if they had any government funding or hope of that. I guess we're going to go through a big change with a different prime minister.
Yes, hopefully, you know, lots of these climate scientists that lost employment, you know, in the last decade, that some of them are stayed in, you know, moved to other countries and stayed in, you know, maybe Australia is not the grave. They'll be coming back from Australia if some of them were there because they had, you know, big cuts, or they're talking about big cuts at their Cicero Science Institute. But it actually amazes me that, you know, how little we really know and understand some of these processes in the ocean that are so important to sustaining life on this planet. Like, phytoplankton are actually quite amazing creatures, and it's estimated that the mass of all the phytoplankton on the planet is about half of the biomass on the Earth, and that's amazing. How can something so small be, you know, have such a large component? So I don't know. I mean, I've seen that number, and I've, you know, tried to confirm it. Maybe some of the listeners can look into that. And also, I've heard things that during the day when the sun is shining, the phytoplankton are proliferating on the surface, and during the night, the zooplankton that generally hang out down in the water column, maybe 100 meters down, they generally migrate upwards at night and do their feeding at night, and that migration of the zooplankton up to the surface is the largest migration of animals on the planet. So you know, these things are happening every day, and most people are really, you know, unaware of that they are happening and that they're extremely important to all life on this planet.
Well, let's move up to the Arctic, Paul. It's been kind of a specialty area for you. Do you think Arctic super warming and the loss of sea ice has affected plankton there?
Well, definitely at both poles, the loss of glacial ice from, say, Greenland and Antarctica has a big impact on phytoplankton, because that ice actually stores up a lot of nutrients over time. And so dust particles falling on the ice, getting embedded in the ice, build up. And as it melts, they're in the meltwater that goes out to sea, and they're high in nutrients. So if an iceberg breaks off, say, calves off Greenland or Antarctica and travels through the ocean, then to melt, travels to lower latitudes, then it can leave a trail hundreds of kilometers long of phytoplankton in the wake of the iceberg, because as it's melting, the nutrients are all coming off and stimulating the phytoplankton growth there. In terms of the sea ice melting back and the snow cover melting back and the Arctic becoming a lot darker, the seawater is getting a lot warmer. Generally in the Arctic, there's very good mixing. You don't get stratified layers of water like you do at lower latitudes. You do get some layers of higher, for example, fresh water floating on top of the saltier seawater. You can get cases where you have warm water being of higher density than colder water because of a big salinity difference. So then some of the warmer water can be deeper down and the colder water can be at the surface. And you get some things like that happening. But generally, you don't have a barrier to vertical mixing. So you get lots of vertical mixing. Now, what you do have, of course, if you have the sea ice and snow cover on top of the sea ice, then the light is not able to penetrate into the seawater. So that really inhibits the phytoplankton growth. There are some types of phytoplankton that grow on the undersurface of the ice. And, of course, as the ice thins and you can get more phytoplankton growing on the underneath the ice because you get more light penetration, and then that will contribute as a positive feedback to melting more ice. Also, at the edges of the ice, there's lots of phytoplankton and lots of sea life, and you know that's where the ring seals go, and that's where the polar bears used to feed off when the ice was sturdy enough to hold them. But of course, that's all changing now. So the Arctic ecosystem is changing more quickly than any other region on the Earth. And as parts of the seawater over the eastern Siberian Arctic shelf have warmed 5 to 7 degrees above normal, and these currents extend down, this warm water extends down to the seafloor, which is a big concern for thawing out methane class rates and increasing methane emissions in the Arctic. So you really need to look at all of the aspects. I know you want me to just talk about phytoplankton, but I have to bring in all of these other elements into our discussion as well.
Yeah, that's the environment they live in, so I can see how all of those could be factors. What do you think, Paul, of this paper by Sergei Petrovsky, who found that with enough warming, there could be a massive die-off of phytoplankton, the plant type of plankton that provides most of our oxygen, as we've said?
Yes, well, I mean, there's a number of factors that cause that, and I guess the largest factor is that the warming of the water, again, stratifies it, so it really decreases the concentration of nutrients that make it to the surface water where the phytoplankton are growing, so they don't have the food supply, so they just don't grow as quickly or as large or as fast. And, of course, the other thing is that, like any other plant, there's an optimum temperature range over which the yields from plants is the highest, and generally as you increase temperature, if they grow faster and larger and quicker, and then they reach a threshold, and then they drop very, very quickly, and you reach a temperature where they're just too stressed to grow. And another thing is the ecology of the growth, so the types of phytoplankton. There's many different types of phytoplankton, and the different ratios between the different types changes, and what we tend to see in the Arctic as we get warming is that we get a tendency to get to smaller and smaller phytoplankton. That's true not just with the plants, but also with animals and things. So we're seeing these massive changes, and it's really, you know, some of the interactions are quite complex. But we need to understand what's happening in order to make any predictions of where we're heading to. Say if we go to a completely blue ocean event where there's no sea ice at all.
Yeah, and then, as you'll recall, a private promoter named Russ George experimented with dumping iron filings into the sea to feed the plankton off the island of Haida Gwaii on Canada's west coast. It is geoengineering. Do you think we will end up trying to remedy the lack of nutrients to save the plankton?
Well, yes, that's a very good question. Of course, that experiment with the iron, I mean, it worked. It generated enormous phytoplankton blooms. And for the subsequent 2 years after that was done, there were record salmon runs in that region. And many scientists are reluctant to relate them, but I think it's very clear that record salmon runs, they're clearly related to the increase in phytoplankton in that region. So how do we get the nutrients? If we can get the nutrients from below, you know, 100 meters below the surface, up to the surface, then we can stimulate these phytoplankton blooms in the open ocean in vast regions of the Pacific, for example, that are considered deserts in terms of lack of sea life. So for example, there's ideas where you construct a large tube that you suspend several meters below the surface, and it's connected to a buoy that's floating on the surface, and then ocean waves lift up the buoy. So the buoy will move up and down with the ocean waves, so it will pull the pipe up and down. And if you have a one-way valve at the bottom of it, then you can use the wave energy to basically pull water up from about 100 meters or 200 meters below. And that water being pulled up will be colder and will contain lots of nutrients and could stimulate a phytoplankton bloom in that region. And then, for example, if you had other structures in the ocean water nearby, you could start getting other marine life growing on those structures, et cetera. So create sort of like an artificial reef in the middle of the ocean. And there's actually been some work done, you know, on that sort of concept of stimulating phytoplankton growth. Also, if you had, for example, wind turbines in the ocean and that had pumps and pumped water up from depth, that could stimulate phytoplankton blooms and things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised. In fact, I think that I've talked about the three-legged bar stool. We need to do carbon dioxide removal, and I think that is one of the most promising methods to do carbon dioxide removal, to get nature, sort of its biomimicry, if you like. How do you get nature to work in your favor?
Speaking of impacts on the food chain, I've seen a lot of news lately about the die-off of sea mammals and sea birds on the west coast of North America. We get thin, sick whales washing up, or starving sea lions, or masses of dead birds from Alaska all the way down to California. And I know some of my listeners attribute this to radiation from Fukushima, but I'm wondering, Paul Beckwith, could the trouble be really with plankton off the west coast?
Yeah, I think a lot of the problem is because of the plankton, would be my view. The oceans are enormous. Although there's huge amounts of radiation that has been dumped continuously from Fukushima, you know, tons and tons of water. I mean, it's just like an open loop. They bring in the seawater to cool and then send it right back out into the ocean. I mean, as horrible as that is, the ocean is still diluting lots of that, you know, that radiation. So I would say it's much more plausible that the die-off of these creatures is due to their general lack of food supply. And it's been exacerbated this year, of course, by the massive El Nino, which is still very powerful and will continue to be strong, probably at least for the next 3 or 4 months, I would guess. Maybe longer. It's, of course, been in record strength, and it's still continuing. So it's affecting climate and water temperatures and stuff, you know, globally, conditions globally. So, and we also saw the so-called warm blob, you know, just south of the Bering Strait for extended periods of time. And then we saw a very warm blob just off California that was contributing to that drought. And that's been sort of persistent for many years. And then we saw the buildup of the very strong El Nino, which initially amplified those other warm blobs. And then, but now they've essentially pretty much disappeared. And it'll be interesting to see if they recover. So we have the El Nino on top of the global warming, the abrupt climate change. We're definitely seeing ocean patterns changing, ocean currents changing, both in the Pacific Ocean and in the Atlantic Ocean. And that study that I mentioned that looked at the diatoms from 1998 to 2012 globally talked of I think the North Pacific was the region where there was the largest drop of diatoms, and followed by North Indian Ocean and Equatorial Indian Ocean. So we have all these things going on which are affecting the marine life.
And you just did a video on YouTube on plankton, and that's unusual for you. It's not like your other communications on the Arctic and methane and jet stream changes and all that. What spurred you to talk to folks about plankton?
Well, you know, I've been aware of this study with the 40% decline, and I'd seen some articles about the Indian Ocean, about the decline of phytoplankton in the Indian Ocean. I kind of remembered that was a region where I thought there was a proliferation of phytoplankton. So then I started digging a bit and came across the paper about the Northern Hemisphere changes and also about some of the new satellite sensors and what they're doing and so on. So I thought I'd look into that, and because, of course, it's a very important area. Of course, that got me really thinking about oxygen levels in the atmosphere, like what's happening with them. I mean, I have done a little bit of research in the past on what the oxygen levels are doing in the atmosphere, of course, because if we're losing that much phytoplankton, then definitely the oxygen level should be dropping. But, fortunately, oxygen is not a trace gas. It makes up 21% of our atmosphere, 78% is nitrogen, a little bit of argon, and then you have the trace gases, greenhouse gases are still trace gases. The increased combustion of burning of fossil fuels is obviously using up oxygen, because when we burn something, it's basically carbon reacting with oxygen, producing carbon dioxide, so it uses up oxygen. So, but as the greenhouse gases, as CO2 grows, say from 300 to 400 ppm, that's a rise of, 100 parts per million, and if you have a drop of oxygen of 100 parts per million, it won't even show up. We go down from 21% to, lose 100 parts per million. You're not even going to notice it, right? As you go up to a higher altitude, the oxygen level drops, right? So you're not even going to notice it. But I think with some of these smart sensors that people are starting to produce, it would be great to carry a device which measured the oxygen level and the CO2 level and the methane level on sort of a watch-sized device. And then if we had metrics like that, instrumentation like that, it would make people a lot more aware. Because go, walk next to a highway, and I'm sure the oxygen level is nowhere near 21%. It's probably 10 or 15%. You start getting headaches and stuff. It's not just from the noxious fumes, but it's from the combustion of all those cars combusting burning the oxygen in the air in your particular region. So I'm going to do a video very shortly about the oxygen levels, because the Earth has gone through periods where oxygen levels were about double what they are. Well, not double. I mean, right now we're 21%. During the Carboniferous, when there was no ice on the planet and things were much greener, we had green coverage everywhere, the biomass was enormous, we had about 30% oxygen in the atmosphere. Whereas in other periods, we've had as little as 13, 14, 15% at surface level on the planet. And of course, these affect things a lot. When the oxygen was 30%, the atmospheric pressure was higher. And of course, it changes the morphology of animals. For example, insects were enormous at that time, and it was very easy for things to fly because the atmosphere was thicker. So the metabolism was completely different, because less energy would need to be expended by animals to extract the oxygen out of the air that they needed, because the oxygen levels were much higher. So therefore, more of the animal would be developed, and there'd be less muscle, less systems in the animal to extract oxygen from the air. It would be a lot easier. So therefore, the animals could be much bigger, for example. So I'm looking at some of these aspects right now. I find it's quite fascinating.
All right, we've got to wrap up at this point. Tell listeners about your new website and about the videos that you've been posting on YouTube.
Yeah, so if you haven't, please have a look at paulbeckwith.net and peruse the menus. And I do post, I try to do a new video every few days or so, and post it up onto the website and put all lots of other stuff there. So please have a look at that. And also you can find me easily on Facebook and Twitter and many different places on the web.
We've been talking with the one and only Paul Beckwith. He's got two master's degrees, and that's while he's working on his PhD at the University of Ottawa in climate science. Paul is a great communicator. You can check out his YouTube channel, his new website at paulbeckwith.net. I'll put links to that and his very active Facebook page in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Thanks again. I love listening to you talk, Paul. I really do.
Well, thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world. Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.